Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Wednesday morning. It's the 10th of January. Very nice to have you with us. 15 minutes past 9 o'clock. And listening to the music of Juliana Hatfield singing ELO this morning. ELO. And if you'd like to see the playlist, all you have to do is go to our website, wamc.org/roundtable. wamc.org/roundtable. Let me introduce the group to you. And we'll get started. We have a lot to go over today. And we welcome your letters as always. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin, joins us. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. Good morning, everybody. Happy New Year to folks that I may not have seen or said it before.
Yes. Yeah. Good to see you.
Thank you. It's a day we can celebrate today, Joe. It's a peculiar people day, so I embrace today's national day.
Isn't every day peculiar people day?
For me, yes.
Yes, I find either one of them myself or in close proximity to peculiar people.
I take that personally.
But peculiar people are much more interesting.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Quite frankly, Jay, and I'd have to think of this thoroughly, but just an off the hip answer is I don't think you get on this panel unless you're peculiar.
Fair enough.
I think it's one of the criteria that we look for. Jay Jacknowitz is with us, semi-retired, but editor at large, at columnist and editorial writer for the Times Union. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm well, and Happy New Year. To you guys and to listeners and everyone. Yeah.
Yeah. It's there's always that point of like when do you stop saying Happy New Year? But it's still new, it's still fresh. We're still seeing people. And it is a good nice to kind of hit a reset in some way. Kind of take stock, so that's good. And so we'll try to do over the next few days as we get mired into the actual year of 2024. And I think it'll probably happen just about the same time as the Iowa caucuses. That's my guess. That's when reality will hit. We are also pleased to have the founder of Capital District Latinos and our dear friend Dan Arizari with us this morning, who joins us. And Dan, thank you very much for being here. Good to have you aboard.
Good to be here once again. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right. One of the cooler entrances we just had.
Yes.
He
sat down right on cue.
He just needed to walk on music.
Right on cue. It's just like perfect. All right. Let's go to what is happening in the world. And we'll start with, I don't think this is any big shock, but here we go. The former president of the United States, Donald Trump, went before a panel of three federal judges, appellate judges, to claim sweeping immunity from criminal prosecution and concerns about the implications. The judges were, in a word, skeptical, it appeared, from the questioning. Now, there were new cameras allowed in the court, but audio did come, was available, and was played. So we have some sense as to the mood in the room. The justices had concerns about the implication, with one of them suggesting that it would allow a future president to have a political rival assassinated by the military without repercussions. Seems like that would be a problem.
Yeah.
Trump argues that he cannot be tried for trying to overturn the 2020 election results because he was acquitted by the Senate of inciting the January 6th, 2021 Capitol attack. James Pierce, a Justice Department lawyer, called that an extraordinarily frightening proposition. The three judges on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit tasked with reviewing Trump's claims, which were rejected by his trial judge last month, appeared to agree during the hour-long hearing. And again, it's this argument, which I just is that you were acquitted by the Senate, and then you are not responsible for your actions. A president could sell pardons, could sell military secrets, could order SEAL Team 6 to assassinate a political rival, said Judge Florence Pan. Would such a president be subject to criminal prosecution if he's not impeached? D. John Sauer, who was representing Trump, insisted that for any crime connected to a president's official duties, the political process, quote-unquote, of impeachment and conviction by the Senate would have to occur before prosecution. He predicted that if a president was involved in murder, he would be speedily impeached. The panel could issue a ruling at any time, potentially delaying the March trial that Trump is seeking to push back until after the presidential election, in which he is the leading Republican candidate. The hearing, which included references dating back to George Washington's tenure, showed how the historic prosecution of Trump has raised difficult questions largely avoided for more than two centuries about the limits of presidential power and the consequences of presidential crimes. It seems amazing to me that it took us nearly 250 years
to elect a wingnut like this
to come up with a Donald Trump character that actually could poke holes into the fabric of our democracy. Bob.
Talk about an extraordinary, frightening proposition. I listened to yesterday's proceedings. It was difficult to listen to, Joe, because part of me was saying this is so absurd. We shouldn't even need to have this discussion. And the other was how important this case is to trying to reestablish a sense of where justice is in this country. And before I sort of lean towards the absurdity of the situation, I think it's really important that the courts help define a distinction between legitimate policy issues where presidents deserve protection and immunity versus criminal or personal behavior that a president shouldn't be able to hide behind the office for. And I thought the questioning from the judges was well thought out and remarkable. I had a huge issue with the response from Trump's attorney. I had a tough time listening to his voice. I was trying to figure out if I could ever replicate how his voice sounded so our listeners could hear it, and I just don't drink enough moonshine, smoke enough camels, or inhale enough helium to be able to do that. But I mean, there's some important questions here that need to get resolved, and it's things like what is the official duty? And if you think about what Trump has done is that he's claimed immunity from things like sexual assault and digital rape fomenting rebellion against the country as part of official duty. So this idea of what is an official duty, I think, becomes really important, and we need to help clarify that. The other thing that this drove home, and I'll turn it over to the other panelists, is two thoughts I had is the irony about Trump's position is that if he really believes this, then what would stop someone like Joe Biden, other than the fact he's a decent human being, from saying, well, okay, I can take care of some of the country's problems, then I have immunity. The other issue that I would like to talk more about is my stunning lack of confidence in the fairness of the Supreme Court, and the fact that it was heartening to see justices sort of puzzle through some key, constitutional issues. But then I keep thinking about the lack of confidence I have in the morals and principles of the majority of the Supreme Court at this time. So a lot more issues to talk about.
Jay?
Yeah, that was my first and last, I had a lot in the middle, but those are my first and last reactions when I read the story, that, you know, whether I'm heartened by what the Court of Appeals judges were saying and what I where I think they're going with this, it ultimately is going to be, you know, completely relitigated as far in the Supreme Court's mind. They're not going to worry about the inconveniences, I think, of well-reasoned opinions from lower courts. They're just going to, you know, find a way to dismiss them. And, you know, unfortunately, for better or worse, you learn to do that in law school, you know, to make your argument based on what you think the law says or you want the law to say. You know, I think the last time we spoke about this, I mentioned this, and I think it's real important in terms of the originalists on the court, that when the Federalist papers, in the Federalist papers that were written about the question of whether, you know, who convicts, who is the trial court, there was a lot of discussion about it. And one of the reasons that the Supreme Court has absolutely no role in impeachment, according to the, I don't remember which Federalist paper it was that it was understood that following impeachment of a president and conviction or any public official and a subsequent criminal prosecution were two completely different things, and since the Supreme Court would eventually or could potentially eventually. Be asked to rule on the criminal prosecution, on the legality of it, the constitutionality of it, and so forth, of a former president or public official, they should have no role in the impeachment. Otherwise, it would seem that they're predisposed to do whatever they did. They've already prejudged the case. So the premise is built in to the Constitution. It's built into the discussion that went on to the Constitution that you can prosecute, you can hold a person accountable after they've left office. I don't even think there ought to be a debate about it, but there's going to be, because, you know, that's the way the legal system works.
One of the things, too, and I just want to get to Dan, but, well, let's actually get to Dan, and then I'll take a break, and then I'll come back with
you. Sure, Joe?
Yeah. Okay. Absolutely.
It's, first of all, it was great to hear the arguments, even though, you know, as a layperson, there are a lot of references that, you know, case law that you almost want to run somewhere and ask ChatGPT to give you an update on what that
right.
exactly means. Yeah. But
in 100 words, explain.
Right. But I think one of the good things that we can take away from yesterday was that we heard the arguments, because in other societies. Well, first of all, there might not even be a trial, but if there were a trial, you're not going to hear what actually goes on. So I think it was instructive if people were to listen to it and get a sense of what's at stake. And really, it's kind of our civic duty to understand more about the law than we do. A lot of people are forced to learn about the law because they end up, you know, getting arrested or, you know, end up in jail and have a lot of time to scrutinize it. But what gets to me about this whole issue of the courts and Trump indictments, which are legion, is that it's basically, it almost seems like the court or the law is in an analog world when we're in a digital world. So it almost seems that the law can't catch up to somebody like Trump. That the Constitution, even though we can say that the framers did not want, they're fearful of a king, right? That the framers in their wildest dreams, if they had taken mushrooms and ketamine all at once, could not have dreamed up the scenario that we find ourselves in. Because for all of the law and all of the elements of our foundational documents, et cetera, nobody could have imagined, or at least in those documents, there was no envisioning of somebody with such malice that would eventually obtain that office. And that's what makes it all very scary to me.
We'll get into the scariness and some of the other issues here when we come back. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. We'll return. I just can't believe they've all faded out of view. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to the panel discussion this morning. A great group assembled, Bob Griffin, Dan Irizarry, and Jay Jochnowitz. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. I just want to sort of remind us all that one of the arguments that the president, the former president Trump, made yesterday and his lawyers made was that he had been acquitted by the Senate, and while that is true, I do think you have to look at the timing of it. It was the first time that we had ever the Senate was putting a former president on trial to impeach someone who was no longer in office, and so there were a number of votes that came out of that. That were simply not over his guilt or his innocence, but instead over the question of should we even be getting involved in this, which brings up another constitutional question.
But Joe, you're hitting on I think a really critical point of yesterday's hearing is that Trump's lawyer actually argued the complete reverse position that his defenders in the Senate argued. They argued, including Mitch McConnell, that there wasn't enough time and that there is a whole criminal process that was a counterweight to the actions of both January 6th, but also of a president. And that resonated, and while there was a majority of the Senate voting for conviction, it wasn't the supermajority that's required. But the position was it's 180 degrees different than what they argued right. In the Senate. And you know, one of the things as I was thinking about today, and I think one of the things that makes me most angry sometimes at Trump is this sense that the law is a plaything for him and frankly a plaything for the rich, that because of resources, he can manipulate the system with absurdities that I couldn't afford or wouldn't be afforded to me, that he is given a different set of rights than the rest of us do because of his wealth. And that was kind of playing out in both this case and comments that were being made about the E. Jean Carroll case and I mean, pick any one of the other 91 potential indictments that he's under, that there is a problem in this country that there are different sets of justice and laws that we need to as a community resolve.
Jay?
I also didn't find his lawyer's assurance assuring.
Is it a qualified yes, Jay?
What?
Is
no,
it a qualified yes? Wasn't no, that the term it, that he used for no?
It was when he said that, well, if on the SEAL Team 6 scenario, he said, well, if a president murdered somebody, of course it would be, I can't remember the word he used, but it would be a speedy impeachment and conviction.
Yeah, speedy.
And, you know, let's, you know, just to backtrack a little, you know, this is a president, first of all, got away with obstruction of justice. That was well documented in the Mueller report, no matter what the Bill Barr and the Trump people want to say. He got away with that because of the no prosecuting your president on official duties. Okay, you could argue it was sort of an official duty to be making a phone call to. No, that was the other one. That was on the Russia thing. But he was acquitted by the Senate.
Just sad we can't keep it. Like, it is hard to keep up with. It's very hard to keep up with.
But he was acquitted by the Senate on, I thought, a well-proven case of extortion and self-dealing and everything else that went along with that on the perfect phone call to Ukraine. and he was acquitted on insurrection. So, you know, what's next for Donald Trump if he's elected president? I put nothing past him, and I don't think as absurd and wild as that scenario sounded about SEAL Team 6 doing an assassination, it's like he just, well, all right, maybe not that far, but he could go pretty far with that.
Well, I don't know. It seemed like I was like, well, just give him a couple more months,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. It doesn't seem that far-fetched from where we've been. But.
And it doesn't seem that far-fetched that he would find a way, and the Hannitys of the world and the Levins of the world and the Stefanics of the world and the Bannons of the world and so forth will all find a way to say, actually, this was okay because Joe Biden would have done it, or Bill Clinton would have done it, or everybody does it. What about all the, you know, the murders that the Clintons were responsible for? You know, I mean, they'll just, and then the American public just, you know, its head explodes, and it just, oh, could we just, like, earn a living and go to work? And
it's like, I think I've used this analogy before, but it's like, you know, the bullfight, right? When the matador comes out, it isn't until the picadors, who have these sharp poles, they stick it in the bull to weaken the bull, then the matador comes out and deals the final blow. Trump's surrogates, the representatives in Congress who just have parroted his messages, mm-hmm. they have weakened democracy. Yeah. And Trump just has to come in and deal the fatal blow by getting elected.
Mm-hmm.
But the work has already been done. He's done it, too. He's prepped. You know, he's just constantly his messaging. And I think that's a real years from now, if we survive as a democracy, historians will look at how successful he was in converting the minds of so many people to follow him so unerringly. I mean, there was an interview on one of the cable news networks where they talked to a supporter in Iowa, and she said, well, you know, they persecuted Jesus, and they crucified Jesus. And I'm going, first of all, my father was a pastor, so probably rolling in his grave at that sentence. But to think that there are people that hold that to be true in 2024, it just tells you everything you need to know about how effective this madman has been in brainwashing people.
And also people around him and people who support him. I mean, the iconography, it's not just memes at this point. You know, the icons of Trump and Jesus together, you know, that you see on social media and you saw during his term, I think had an effect on people who look at that and go, wow, yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I wish Tim Alberta had written his book, you know, 8 years ago. But that is what he talks about. That this is no longer a case of, you know, political leader. This is a cult leader who has summoned a great number of evangelicals, which are a huge voting block, to his side, and that's just a shame.
I think there are people. When you say historians are going to be looking at this for years, I think political strategists are already looking at this in a way that historians, you know, wouldn't. Historians might look at this as a morality issue, you know, how do we avoid this issue? And I think political strategists are saying, how do we duplicate this?
You're seeing a number of articles, at least I have in Times and Post and Wall Street Journal and the like, of what kind of Christian is supporting Donald Trump? And those questions are being asked, and it's an interesting, I don't think it's easily answered, but it's an interesting look.
I know I've said this years ago, that it was a failure of the Democratic Party to engage in the religious argument. And I'm not saying that, you know, the Democrats should assume some mantle of being Christian, right? But there are people in the religious community. I mean, Joe Biden is a church-going Catholic. Yet we have you know, a guy who's been guilty, found guilty of well, not guilty of rape, but, you know, it's been pretty much accepted.
Accused.
By, yeah. Accused, but also the judge kind of Correct. Said yeah. that it happened.
Yeah.
And everything else that we know about. And Joe Biden, who doesn't wear his religion on his chest, that they would look at both of them and just, you know, say that one is closer to God than the other is just amazing to me. But it also goes to the fact that Democrats have failed to compete in certain areas when it comes to the dialogue, the narrative, like patriotism. You know, we now have Donald Trump coming out, looking like a walking flag with this hideously long red tie, never fails to wear the same costume, mm-hmm. right? And somehow he has become a symbol of patriotism. Mm. Why? Because people have failed to engage on that battlefield about what is a patriot.
Mm.
And the same with religion. What is a Christian? Who is a Christian? I mean, there are some indisputable, you know, rules about what you profess or what you do. So it's not like we can't pass judgment on this stuff, but I think the Democratic Party has made a huge mistake by not engaging in those arenas.
Well, the far-right commentators that I've listened to over the years have made a real effort to diminish any of the more liberal churches.
Mm-hmm.
And I use liberal not in a political sense, but in kind of a social justice sense. In fact, social justice is one of the big slurs mm-hmm. that they throw out there. And they attack the Catholic Church for that reason, and they attack you know, other churches that have more of a social mission and more of a liberal approach to LGBTQ issues, and so forth.
Right.
So there's been a long effort to move it to the hardcore. Conservative fundamentalist, but as you mentioned, Joe, you know, that article that the Times had the other day with that art of the woman with her hand up, you know, deep in prayer and something, you know, saying she doesn't even go to church anymore. She's got a special relationship with the Lord, and Donald Trump and the Lord are part of that relationship, and Donald Trump is actually at the top of the.
Well, and Trump, you know, also is releasing, I think,
evangelical food chain.
Yeah.
The poor basic instinct of a lot of people. So think about someone like a congresswoman who is in upstate New York who won't repudiate violence, or talks about or claims to be a supporter of police and public safety, but then won't repudiate January 6th, where police officers were killed by Trump supporters storming the Capitol, who now they're trying to rebrand them as hostages.
Right.
You know, that there's this, you have to ask yourself, you know, with your Harvard education, Elise, are you, did they not teach you how to logic, or is it just that your desire for personal aggrandizement and power trumps any morals that you would have had? And I think what you're seeing is that the sewage in these Trump pipes is collecting a lot of people that don't have principles and morals, don't care about the community, don't care about the country, and are more than willing to wrap themselves in religion, in patriotism, in symbolism, in ways that we haven't seen in used in this country. But we've seen used in other places by autocrats and dictators.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have many letters on this. We'll go to those and further the conversation after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We have Bob Griffin, Jay Jochnowitz, and Anna Rosari with us. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. And we want to get to the letters on the subject of the hearing that took place and the three judges showing some skepticism to the president's want of immunity. Democracy in the U.S. is in the ICU on life support and is already dead below the waist, writes John. And the berserker caucus in Congress is trying to pretend trip over the plug. And you, and for you, Pendens, by democracy, I mean the democratic republic that is in the form of government created by the founding fathers. That from John. On that happy note, we go to Diana. Giving Trump carte blanche to do whatever he wants really sounds like giving him permission to be a dictator to
yes.
me. That certainly seems to be the, well, that's the want, right? I mean, I think that's...
It has been for a long time. I think we sort of all sort of chuckled at his comment about being able to shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and not be held accountable, but... this is a. Yep. This is
never
a.
Never thought you'd hear it in court, right?
I wouldn't. You're right. And you know what's scary to me, Joe, is that when you start to pair that with the language about vermin like me, you know, I mean, because you know, I'm sure that he would vote. He would. Trump and Trump supporters would look at the roundtable and the people who listen to the roundtable as part of that vermin class that Trump identified. And you think about. Taking the comments about where he thinks he has the rights to do, it's like, so what happens when, you know, what would stop mass incarcerations? What would stop him from shutting down, you know, NPR and the Times and Free Press? I mean, all of these are, I mean, he's not apologizing for this. He's setting us up for an apocalyptic 4 years if he is elected. And I would say I can't even say 4 years, Joe, because I don't think he would ever step back from power because he couldn't afford to.
Right. Yeah. There's no guarantee. Once you're in, you're in. Right.
And I think we're really focused on all of these trials and all of the controversies surrounding Trump. I think maybe I should just speak for myself. I don't even want to think about what might happen should Trump lose. And we're back into where we were 4 years ago with, especially when someone like Elise Stefanik, we were talking in the break, says, I'm not going to certify it. I'm going to withhold judgment. Where are we at that point? Because... that's the other scenario. It's almost as terrifying as thinking that Trump might be elected. I mean, we're going to be going through we've been through a nightmare for 8 years. The past 3 years has been just unbelievably nightmarish. So are we going to continue to live through this because we can't deal with this rogue character, either politically or through the courts? I mean, that's a frightening prospect. And I have been putting it off, you know, thinking about that. But that's the next step.
Except if the institutions are in place, then there's still a rule of law that I would argue that any continued violent insurrection or support of violent insurrection could be resolved through a justice system that may be flawed, but is fairer than what we would have under Trump. If you go under Trump, there will be I have no guarantees at all as to what fairness would be. I mean, he's coming right out and saying that he believes he really believes that he has the right to assassinate or kill a political opponent, someone who he doesn't like. Simply because he is the president of the United States. Basically, what they're trying to do is they're positing a trying to create a legal standard that the president has godlike, certainly,
king-like.
You know, powers over to do anything he or she wants to do.
Absolute monarchy, one term at a time. You know, and, yeah.
I mean, to Dan's point, though, of this imagining what would happen if Trump loses. I mean, we're sort of already there, though, right? I mean,
replay.
I mean, we haven't left that.
Right.
I mean, from the days after, obviously, the insurrection of January 6th, but that lie hasn't gone anywhere. And if anything, it's just the snowball rolling down the hill and getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And and trying to figure out, and you know, in some quarters, in many quarters, it's just
2020 redux. It's
believed.
Just,
yeah.
Just going go through the whole thing.
But you say that then, Joe, but then how do we get our arms around the fact that there are good people in Iowa, okay? Yet if the caucuses come out the way the polls seem to indicate, he's going to get a mass support from people who you say what happened? You know, how could that be? Because I struggle with how anybody could support this man. You know, maybe I give it 10% of crazy people, but his numbers are bigger than that.
Yeah, they are. Another interesting article yesterday about how Iowa became so red, looking at that changing demographic. It used to be a bellwether because it would give you a fairly clear idea on both sides, which is no longer the case, obviously. Let's go to more letters. We go to Keith, who says Trump is a predictable outcome to a disinvestment in education. I remember growing up in the 90s and politicians demanding budget cuts, including education, an undereducated population susceptible to grifters. Con men and cults were concerns about cutting educational budgets. Trump loves the poorly educated. Then
I don't know. I think it's much more nuanced than that. I think there's a whole lot of societal issues and concerns that are wrapped up into this. I don't disagree that education is a big part, a big piece, and but I'm not going to say that because we've stopped talking or teaching civics that this is the only reason. I think there are a lot of issues, and the problem I have is that there are a lot of legitimate concerns. There are a lot of legitimate concerns about, you know, about where the country's going, where the economy's going, things like that. And there's definitely, we're definitely as people talking past each other, because if you're doing well, you're doing really well. If you're not doing well, you're doing horribly. So this idea that, oh, it's a good economy, it is for some, but it's not for a lot.
You know, it's wrong to say that all of Trump's support is among, you know, the hoi polloi. You have people like Elise Stefanik from elite institutions that are just, you know, paving the way, making it real easy for this character to assume power again. So, yes, there are a lot of people who are just grievance kind of aligned, and so there's a lot of reasons why they might be angry at government, et cetera, and he's tapped into that. But don't for a second think that the elites in this country are not facilitating his candidacy, his administration. They are front and center as well.
I think I'd have to agree with you on the education issue too. That I was thinking in recent days, and I haven't, like, it hasn't gelled into a full column yet. But the difference, I was struck by Elise Stefanik's comment: the American people are smart. And they will see through, you know, Joe Biden's crime family or something like that. And I thought, you know, there's a difference between being smart and being wise. And education will make you reasonably smart in terms of knowledge, and you'll be a functioning worker in society and all that. But it's the wisdom that comes with, and again, liberal with a small L, a liberal arts type education, a good grounding in civics, a good understanding of what the principles of this country are and how they play in real life and all that. What I think the education system is up against, other than, you know, the movement, the kind of anti-intellectualism that's pervasive nowadays in the Republican Party, is propaganda on a mass scale. Whether it's Fox, whether it's the radio, whether it's social media, whether it's websites, people are, you know, reading themselves into niches, and they're not getting a broad look at things, and they're getting their worst prejudices or their built-in biases reinforced constantly. So, you know, I don't think you get out of that very easily, and I think that's, you know, that's probably, I don't even know how you address that. I mean, that's a free choice issue, you know? Yeah.
Well, we'll take a break and we'll get back to our little niche right after this news break with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this 10th day of January. Bob Griffin, Jay Jochnowitz, and Dan Arasari with us this morning. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We have a number of letters still on Donald Trump's legal proceedings yesterday, and I'm just going to roll through them pretty quick. If anybody has anything to say, please interrupt me. Otherwise, I'll just get to those and we'll move on to other subjects. Vesta says, Trump's Fifth Avenue claim was invoked that he could shoot someone and not be held accountable. Why not shoot 100 or shoot members of Congress who attempted to impeach him? The question is how much or little this immunity claim may change the March 4th trial date. This case probably is the only one that has a chance of being tried before the election. Then we go to Amy, who says, Biden said it best. We know who Trump is. Now we have to decide who we are. This election is entirely about us as Americans, a populace who, I would agree, is far removed from the meaning of democracy. Trump has tapped into the cult of celebrity, the cult of zero-sum game, and the cult of personality, which unfortunately has been exacerbated by social media in everyday life. I'd just like to say that if anyone, and it was interrupted by protesting, but Biden's speech in South Carolina was really good. I mean, as far as an antidote to what is happening in court and what Trump is saying on the campaign trail, it was a very compelling argument about where the country is headed, I thought.
I agree.
I think it was again. It was somewhat the coverage of it had more to do with the interruptions than the content. But it was, I thought, pretty sharp.
Well, if you're gonna call Trump out as a liar, you know, which he did in that speech, I think it's effective to have kept your powder dry for 3 years before you use it. I think it's a little bit more effective now when he just says he's a liar.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. All right. Let's go to a few more letters here. We go to Melinda. You are all covering all the concerns Trump has created. I don't understand how so many citizens of this country can't see through him. It's all very scary. Pat said, stop taking what Trump lawyers are saying so seriously. They know their arguments are nonsense. They're only trying to buy time so the trial doesn't begin until after the election. I just asked the question, which I think is valid, which is, okay, but how do those same arguments, how are they treated by the United States Supreme Court?
Right, right, because there is a chance that these ridiculous arguments actually become woven into the fabric of the law given this Supreme Court. And as ridiculous as I think this absolute claim of immunity for any action is, you think about how the court has been willing to take their own personal needs, desires, and philosophies and basically throw out American jurisprudence. I mean, so look at the Dobbs case, the overturning of Roe v. Wade. Look at the decisions that Alito has made. Look at the fact that Clarence Thomas, that we don't know whether Clarence Thomas would recluse himself from a case in Trump, even given his wife's involvement in the insurrection movement, let alone say anything about the lack of morals and ethics in people like Alito and Clarence Thomas. So, unfortunately, you have to take this seriously because they're putting cases in front of us that would empower a Trump president to basically do whatever he wants to do.
And I tend to think the Supreme Court on this one is going to surprise us pleasantly. I think Thomas may well be the dissenting voice just so transparently. So I think the place where they're going to protect him, and I don't know that they want that it's about protecting him. I think it's about trying to position the court where the court really wants to be, which is looking as neutral as possible and as for the republic as possible, as opposed to just, you know, this various, you know, the law, the Constitution, and so forth. I think what they're going to do is they're going to say in the Colorado case, in the question of whether he can be on the ballot, they're going to say proving and documenting and all that an insurrection under the 14th Amendment is more complicated than two states have made it out to be, and he's got to be on the ballot. And that'll satisfy the popular will. But I think in this case, I just don't see the argument out of this. I don't think he's going to get – I think they're going to say no. Immunity is not something – permanent lifetime immunity from acts in office is not something the president's entitled to, especially if they're not official acts and these were not official acts.
I hope so. I just think they're rotten to the core.
Yeah.
Well, and it also plays into all the other decisions that they're going to have regarding this former president and the election and going forward. So there's a lot there, right? So there may be, if you get, even if you're pleasantly surprised on this, oh, the disappointment will come.
Oh, I'm sure it will. I'm sure it will. And I think I think this decision will prove whether they're rotten to the core or not. Or it'll certainly cement it one way or the other. Either cement it or disprove it, maybe.
I look forward to hearing what Trump has to say if they decide against him. Could you imagine what that discussion
is? The most disloyal Supreme Court ever.
I gave them their jobs, and they're very unfaithful, very disloyal.
Trump has already called for an assassination of a general while out of office. He has promised to be a dictator on day one, but we should say just for day one. And so I have no doubt that he
we don't know how many hours are in that day one.
I have no doubt that he would, if elected to the presidency. That is from Linda. We then go to Tim. Isn't it also true that as Trump continues to manipulate the quote-unquote system, the American taxpayers are paying the lion's share of his defense? This is not available to the average citizen. Joel writes, who or what?
Well, I think there's Trump is a lot of Trump's defense is being paid by people who frankly shouldn't and couldn't afford to donate to his different PACs. I mean, again, this guy is a grifter and a con man. My biggest problem is that the more, you know, I listen to and read and hear, this is the Nigerian prince that we all get emails about. I mean, he is, but think about it. He continues to get money from people. But
she needs that kidney operation, Bob.
But Joe, you look at it and you think, you know, we used the term cult before, and you know, having lived when you know cults caused the murder and death of so many of their members. And you look at it right now, Trump doesn't care about anything except Trump.
That's it.
Period. But there's a lot of people who bought into it.
We go to this letter. For decades, people have been bilked by TV evangelists. Trump is the perfect outgrowth of the naivete of such believers. For whatever reason, these people have no ability to discern charlatans. Then Mark says the most recent argument, although I have to come back to what Bob said earlier. I mean, this is not a small number of people.
No.
I mean, if polls are to be believed, this is the majority of those who will be headed to the polls in the fall right now. Now,
the Republicans.
Majority of Republicans, but also maybe the majority. I mean, he's leading in most polls, even in the general election up against Biden. Obviously, a ton can change, so I'm not saying that. But as you say, it's not an insignificant number of people.
No.
I used to think that 28% was about the threshold for craziness in this country, that the 28% was roughly where people believed that Obama was born in Kenya. 28% were the people that believed that were absolutely certain that there was no such thing as global warming. That number has really moved into the, I would say, 46 to 48%, somewhere around there.
Yeah, mid-40s.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Did you see that Trump went after Haley last night with the same questions about her citizenship?
No.
Yeah,
she had done that. He had done that before.
Yeah,
hadn't
he played it again. He played it again last night.
Yeah. Back to the hits. Yeah. Mark says the most recent argument by Trump's lawyer regarding holding a president accountable in court only after impeachment by Congress is ludicrous. It also doesn't square with their earlier argument that prosecution and impeachment present a legal double jeopardy. We've come to a place where the more outlandish the argument, the more we need to check our common sense at the door and take inordinate amounts of time to address the fantasy of the day. Let's see.
It's important that that letter writer hits on something I think that's incredibly important, though. If you follow Trump, I mean, there's the lies are clear. I mean, the double talk, the fact that he contradicts himself, that he takes one position one day, another position another day. But back to your other comment, Joe, it doesn't seem to resonate with rational people who support him. They don't seem to care, which makes me shake my head, going, well, then what would change you away from this person? And that's really scary because you realize there's not much.
And I think it's important to realize for all parties involved, both Democrats and Republicans and those undecided, that a lot of this is not so much a vote for Trump, but it's a vote against Biden. And that there is this concern about the woke left, and they look at it as the lesser of two evils. So that isn't even so much as Trump support as much as people who are looking at what is going on and buying the overall argument that we're moving in a direction that is too far for this country.
It was an analysis piece, the rubber glue analysis that Maggie Haberman and another reporter did today in the Times, talking about what is with Trump constantly saying, I know you are, but what am I, or something like that.
Right.
And I think this is part of it as well, that he paints everything as being equally corrupt. He may be corrupt. He may be a liar, but everyone else lies too.
Right.
So now it's, you know, who are you going to choose? And then it just becomes a popularity contest. And that's, you know, in a popularity contest, the popular talk, reality show billionaire, who's got charisma, whether you like it or not.
You can't take that away from him. No, he's, it's hard to.
But that message. Has to find resonance, right?
Yes.
When you are convincing people that we can return to some idyllic time in which the minorities weren't breaking down the border wall, when black people knew their place, when Hispanics, you know, insert minority here, when you have somebody saying that I know I'm with you, although Trump never has to fear losing his privilege, right?
Yeah.
But everybody else does, right. in the face of changing demographics. And I think we'd like to move beyond it, but that's the frame. He is basically saying this new world, this new global world that we live in, this America where by 2050... minorities will be without number white people. I can stop that from happening. I'm with you. I don't want it to happen. So let's go back to, you know, 1950, when women had no rights, when minorities were segregated. I can give you that again. Just vote me in, because I know how you feel about it.
And it takes us back to the scary scenario I was writing about in 2016, the idea that he was already starting to talk about the idea of, you know, he was going to get the bad ones first, the worst of the worst, the bad hombres, he called them.
Right.
But, you know, we knew where this was going, that, you know, you do that, and then you go after the other 10 million people.
That's textbook. Yeah, that's history.
The idea.
A couple things that I had forgotten to raise real quickly. There were two other points that were raised by Jack Smith's attorney that I thought were really interesting. One is he talked about the sale of classified documents as an example. Mm. And selling pardons.
Yeah.
And I've been looking at a number of articles that sort of are pointing to language that Jack Smith has been putting out in a lot of his court documents, sort of pointing to additional charges and additional issues. Mm. And I do wonder, and I posit that it'll be interesting to see that those are two potential issues that we're going to hear more about. Mm. The sale of pardons or a pay to play for pardons, and some additional elements of the classified document issues.
I found that really interesting too. Yeah, the first one. I didn't pick up on the second one, but you're right. The first one.
Those two issues were specifically woven into that narrative. We're all talking about the SEAL Team 6 one, but those other two are there, and I think that these do impact those other cases.
Timestamp 10:21 this morning, and with a subject line of update, dear friend and patriot, that's me, folks. I was at the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals yesterday defending my rights that are under attack by the Biden special counsel, but I was honestly far more outraged when I learned about this attack on you. A new report shows that crooked Joe Biden's prosecutor Jack Smith spent $7.4 million of your taxpayer money just between April and September alone. The next time you look at your grocery bill, the next time you see a clip of your unsecured southern border getting invaded, remember that Biden's accomplices are lighting your precious money on fire to try and jail their opponent and remain in power. This is why I could never surrender this battle no matter what. Biden and his left-wing accomplices simply do not care about the United States. They do not care about improving the lives of our citizens. They'd sell out America in a heartbeat to make a quick buck. But I love America, and I will never, ever let these sick and twisted people destroy the greatest country in history. If you're with me, I ask you to make a contribution to help ensure victory in the first election of 2024, only 5 days from today. The lowest amount to contribute on this is $24, and the highest amount is $250.
I think this is a wild prediction, but I think if on the day after the election, if he does not win, he will give up this fight. He will go. He will reach out to Joe Biden, and he'll take the pardon if he can get it, and he'll admit. Very reluctantly, he'll admit the way he. I'm telling you, the guy is. I think he's terrified.
Jay,
you're spending
too much time with your chickens,
man.
No. I think you're too.
I think there'll be a pardon. I think Joe Biden will certainly offer him a pardon, but the condition of the pardon is going to have to be you have to admit you did things wrong, and Trump will admit. All right, so I did it. I was wrong about the election.
Man, I hope you're like, I would love to live in that world.
I already live in it.
Okay, well, good for you. I look forward to my invitation in the mail, but I just do not see that given the let's say since 2015, so the last 9 years. But forget that. The 30 years that he's been in the national spotlight would give no indication that would ever happen.
And the 30 years he's been in the national spotlight, he's never faced the possibility of a jail term.
Yeah.
This is very hypothetical.
No, I understand. I understand.
I feel you, Jay. I feel you.
We'll see.
Bob?
I think the Patriots have a better chance of winning the Super Bowl this year than Jay's prediction coming. But I appreciate it. It's good radio. I mean, if you think about Trump, yes, sir, he didn't need to be there. Okay, this is all about, you know, he was there to fundraise.
That's right.
I mean, yeah. He's there to take more money out of the gullible pockets. Yeah.
And I will give credit to much of the press. In fact, even Fox, that made the point over and over again that Trump was at court yesterday but didn't have to be.
Right.
I think that's an important point to be made. All right. Just go through a couple more of these letters just because it'll bring us to the bottom. Yeah, go
Joe,
ahead.
Real quick. That $7.4 million that he was talking about, yeah. that Joe Biden's, that's about the same amount of money that they recently revealed that he had taken in foreign emoluments. Or so, you know, if he was really concerned about that, he'd just have to write a check, right?
And then how much do you think that the motorcade that we definitely paid for as taxpayers that he has, that his protection... And I also think that anybody who is convicted of insurrection shouldn't receive taxpayer protection.
There's a dilemma.
Catherine writes, first, thank you, panel. Second, I view Ms. Stefanik's comment on Americans being smart as a false compliment designed to garner support because she's saying Americans are smart that agree with her. Americans in disagreement with her and by extension, Trump, are not smart. ... Then we go to James. It's called propaganda, folks, which, interestingly enough, was a word started by the church 500 years ago. Propaganda manipulates what people think through the use of symbols, misinformation, and outright lies. Hitler was a master of propaganda, and Trump is using it too. Fox News is propaganda, and wrapping itself up with an American flag is also propaganda. As the old saying goes, don't drink the Kool-Aid. Then we go to Joel. Who or what is to blame for Trump and the threat to democracy? Look no further than the Electoral College. Had it not been for this truly pernicious institution, Hillary Clinton would have been the president of the United States. Thanks a lot, Founding Fathers, writes Joel. Then we go to Tom. Morning, panel. Thank you for allowing me to indulge in this rhetorical, opinionated rant. One, how can we have confidence in a court, a country for that matter, that rules corporations are people too? Two, why hasn't Trump been tried, convicted, and sentenced yet? That from Tom. That was a very short rant. I was expecting it to be a very concise rant. Then we go to GW.
But Joe, the one point that you know.
Just a minute. Go ahead.
The court cases weren't ready, so the investigations went as long as they did. I wish that it was still 2 years in the current administration so that it wasn't as close? Yeah, I do. But at the same time, I think every day more and more bad stuff is coming out on these investigations.
Yeah, and you add to that, he's going to run the clock now.
Absolutely.
I mean, I don't think that was the design of the justice system or Jack Smith's intent by any means. They got to make a good case. This is a big deal.
We're going to want to pause you there because we just have to take a break. We're 15 seconds away. We'll go to a break. When we come back, we'll finish up our time together with this great panel. And we welcome your letters as well in those few minutes. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back after news from the BBC. I couldn't understand the word. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to the panel discussion. We're getting a number of letters about asking who is singing, and that is Juliana Hatfield singing ELO, and you can see the playlist posted online at wamc.org/roundtable, wamc.org/roundtable. All right, folks, we have a few moments left with our terrific group here, and let's get to new items in the news and a new topic for us to discuss. And I want to get to the we've been talking about this for the past 3 days. This is Wednesday. We've been talking about this Monday and Tuesday. And now we know a lot more information than we did. And yet we still have things to sort of process with this. This is in regards to our Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin hospitalized for complications from prostate cancer surgery. That was the headline that came out yesterday. A spokesman said the White House, which had been kept in the dark for 3 days, although we had originally heard it was four, but 3 days about the defense secretary's hospitalization, only learned of the diagnosis yesterday. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has been hospitalized for the past week because of complications after he had prostate cancer surgery, according to Walter Reed National Military Medical Center in a statement yesterday. A hospital official said Mr. Austin was admitted on January 1st with severe abdominal, hip, and leg pain after he underwent what the hospital characterized as a minimally invasive surgical procedure. The defense secretary, who had developed an infection, was put in intensive care where excess abdominal fluid was drained. Since then, his infection has cleared, according to the statement. In finally releasing the details of the ailment that had taken Mr. Austin, second only to the president in the military chain of command, out of action during crises in the Middle East and Ukraine, the Pentagon sought to fix its own unforced error. Mr. Austin had tried to protect his medical privacy. Instead, his secrecy inflated the hospitalization into a full-blown national security crisis. John Kirby, a White House spokesman, said Tuesday that the White House had only learned that day about the diagnosis of prostate cancer. The White House also was belatedly informed of his hospitalization at all. The episode has raised questions about Mr. Austin's personal credibility as well as his department's overall competence. The Defense Department's shifting stories put forth by junior officials seeking to protect their boss have not helped matters at all. The stark breach of protocol has also lessened the credibility of the Pentagon as a whole, lawmakers and current and former American officials said with both the White House and Congress, that from the New York Times. Jay.
I don't see how you get out of this. I don't think you can state it any more clearly than second to the president in terms of national security, and you know all the excuses that have been given. Oh, there was the chief of staff was out, so nobody ever got around to telling anyone. And when she came back, well, then you know people got told, and it's just. For all the political rhetoric that's swirling around this, and you just can't not have that in this country, you know, there's going to be lots of people ready to pounce on it for all sorts of reasons. I just think fundamentally the idea that he was in the hospital, didn't tell key people who needed to know, including the deputy,
yes.
who was the one who would have to act in his absence. How could you not do this? This was reckless.
My wife will know as soon as I leave the studio if I'm headed home or not. How is it, because I have an iPhone and she can track.
Yeah, right.
How is it that...
She can track me.
That's right, honey. I'm sorry about that, but it's true.
Hey, we all got them.
But listen, how is it possible that a person in the chain of command can get, you know, can abscond and nobody know where he's at? Come on, that's just doesn't ring true.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm not saying Walter Reed is akin to the Appalachian Trail. However, when you go away for 4 days,
come on,
and you are second in military command when the world's hotspots are on fire, I don't as you said, Jay, I don't know how you. We had Ambassador Hoff on Monday, and he called for his resignation, saying it warrants that level because someone with 40 years of military experience, even in a civilian role, should know better. And this should not be the case too. And also the predicament that it puts the White House in at a very crucial time. Bob.
Well, I mean, and it's something that is pretty widely known. So when I was the acting undersecretary at DHS, I had to let the operations center know when I was leaving town. I mean, so this idea of not alerting the White House. I mean, the number one rule for any White House is don't surprise us. Okay, and this was an absolute surprise. It creates, you know, concern I have about, you know, obviously I'm concerned about Secretary Austin's health, and I hope he does well, but he either needs to rethink what he's doing, or he needs to surround himself with people who understand that this isn't acceptable. There shouldn't be this much space between the secretary and the deputy secretary. No. if the situation had gotten worse, that left a serious gap in the civilian control over our military, which again is not acceptable. So I agree with I think this is so serious a breach of etiquette and protocol that something is going to have to be done about it.
I think when your best argument is that, well, he's a fiercely private man.
You gave that up when you agreed to be secretary.
When you became a member of the cabinet and you became defense secretary, you gave that up.
But just as a courtesy, you know, if I'm going to stay home sick from as a cold, I'll text my boss. I'll text the provost and say, listen, just to let you know, I've got a stomach bug. I'm not going to be in. It's just, you know, why wouldn't you pick up the phone and call the president's chief of staff and just say, hey, just to let you know?
I think what might have happened, and I'd like to believe this, is that initially it was a quick procedure. I don't really want to tell people that they're messing around down there because I'm, you know, the big, strong, you know, defense secretary or whatever. And then it just got out of hand because the infection set in, and then it became kind of digging a hole for yourself. It could be. That's a generous.
It just seems given protocol, you would just think that even going in for minor surgery, and I know I'll get letters on this to correct me, but you know, and even this is cancer surgery, but a lot of surgeries now that don't require overnight stays are considered minor. That used to be things that kept you hospitalized for days, if not weeks. But you still think that someone should have known that at least this was going on, which is different. And I think we've been saying this all week. Is different than the general public knowing that what his condition is, what he has, what's going on. That's much different than the fact that the people within the Department of Defense and within the White House know what's going on.
Typically, for positions like this, what should have occurred is the White House National Security Council was aware, and a statement is made publicly that the secretary is going to be in for a minor surgical procedure. At this point in time, we don't believe that there will be a transfer of power. That's just sort of the stock language that you get used to in D.C.
And then a protective detail.
Oh yeah. Oh God. Yeah. Right. Absolutely.
I mean, it's a whole entourage.
Yeah. So how does that happen?
Somebody couldn't have picked up the phone and called the White House.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Oh, but the other thing too, Bob, and I've been waiting for you to come on because I thought you would know the answer to this, which is so. At what point do you not notice that the guy's not around? In the sense of, if you're the White House, it seems at some point you would say, "Oh, where's Lloyd?" And so what accounts for that?
Yes. I mean, I think what Lloyd's argument and the people around him's argument is that, he was continuing to work. But you still, my heartburn is that you were in a position where you could have been completely disabled. I would imagine that there, you know, that there was,
anesthesia
applied. There are so many of those elements, Joe, that should have triggered existing protocols. So this idea that we've got to check our protocols. Now you got to follow what you should have done in the beginning.
Now, is it naive of me to think that the defense secretary and the president would be in regular dialogue, and
yes,
if they weren't in regular dialogue over a 4-day period of time, that would be unusual?
I would think so, especially given what's going on in Ukraine, what's going on in Israel. In going on with the Houthis in the Red Sea, you know, I saw again yesterday we in the British Navy were involved in interdicting almost 40 drone and missile attacks from the Houthis. There is no doubt that the White House, whether it's the president directly or whether it's the chief of staff or the National Security Council, would be in contact with the secretary and the secretary's people,
which makes the optics of this just that much
even worse.
Because you know you have and it, and it it's wonderful for a guy like Donald Trump, for example, who was notorious for not paying attention to his daily briefings and stuff. Now he's got, you know, the ability to say, well, Biden doesn't even talk to his, you know, Secretary of Defense. He didn't even know he was missing.
Has there been any talk of hearings? Because that's nice.
Well,
I'm sure there will be.
The White House chief of staff yesterday directed cabinet officers to evaluate their policies for delegating authority when a secretary is incapacitated and to forward those procedures to the White House for review. That's a good reminder.
Too much, too little, too late.
Yeah.
The other thing that, as you said, I mean, this idea of anesthesia being really the trigger for any kind of notification from any cabinet secretary, especially Secretary of Defense, The White House, I think, you know, the president keeps saying that he has support for him, and I don't know whether that will start to erode over the next couple of days or not.
He kind of has to say he has support for him. I mean, you also don't want to kick a guy who's dealing with potential cancer when they're down, but at the same time, what I expect is that they're trying to figure out where's the most palatable landing spot to announce that because of health issues and wanting to spend more time with his family that the secretary will be resigning. So look forward to some Friday afternoon at about,
that's what I was thinking,
you know.
He's the first African-American defense secretary, right, in history? Or am I wrong about that? No.
Need you closer.
Yeah, I'm
just need you closer.
I'm not sure.
I think he is.
Okay.
I think he is the first one.
All right, we are out of time. My thanks to everyone for being with us this morning and for engaging in the conversation.
Thank you.
Jay Jacknowitz, Bob Griffin,
Dan
Arizari. Thank you all.
Thank you, sir.
And peculiar people out there, have a great day.
And
yes.
And also with you.
Yes.
You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC.